Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I always feel like you're being very optimistic when you say boys and girls. Though I am, I have heard that the last program that I was on, my nuclear family listened, including my two-year-old daughter. And she told me when I got home, we listened to you on the radio. And I said, What did I say? And she said, you talk a lot.
Yep. That's
so
probably
pretty well.
Most of our listeners take this away.
Talk a lot.
Yeah, we talk a lot. Let's see. What else is new and interesting and different and unusual out there? We talked about the fact that rising interest rates are finally probably, maybe, perhaps, could be. And I say that it could be coming. And the reason I say that is because we have been looking for interest rates to rise now for about 3 years. And
it's happening.
It's finally starting to happen. But we've been head faked out before. We have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I know you don't give specific investment advice over the radio.
Yeah, we do. Buy low, sell high. Don't get involved in a major land war on the Asian
continent.
That's
not investment. That's
okay, yeah.
Anyway, last couple of weeks there's been a couple of articles trickling in from certain people about U.S. stocks are overpriced and they're moving into European stocks and what's the other term?
Emerging
markets.
Yep.
Thank you, sir. Yep. And I was curious what your comments are on that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I hope you read the newsletter we published yesterday evening.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that they're doing this now because there's a range of about 25% to 40% return last year from emerging markets. So
it's obviously time to get in emerging
right,
markets.
Right, it's a very normal thing to the year after a big growth in a certain asset class for people to say, "Oh, other asset classes are just not as nice as that one. I'm going to go over there." You're already there, then it's a pretty good deal. But if you're not there yet and you're jumping in now, well, you've just missed the upturn.
I think also whoever you're getting the word from probably has an interest in your putting money in emerging markets or foreign stocks. The United States stock market right now is not overpriced, is not underpriced, is not overpriced. European market is probably still underpriced. The emerging markets probably, and it's a little harder to tell because diversified emerging markets covers a lot of ground and a lot of flavors and blends and brands. But
let me throw this in here and say that there's some areas that are absolutely in the stock market. There's no way of really looking at this and saying it's not overpriced. There's some areas that it is extremely overpriced. The price to earnings ratio for Amazon, which I like Amazon. I do a lot of ordering, and most of my groceries and items that I purchase are going through Amazon, but they have a price to earnings ratio of 329, which means if you took all of their earnings from last year and used it to pay back the price of the stock today, it would take 329 years to pay back the price of the stock.
There's another aspect to this when people say American stocks are overpriced, so I'm going to invest in Europe. Probably, at last I read, in the S&P 500, 40% of the earnings of the S&P 500 come from overseas. So if you're invested in domestic stocks, you're invested in – you have roughly 40% of your earnings in U.S. domestic stocks, if they're in the S&P 500, are coming from outside the United States. There is no real delineation right now, clear delineation between – European stocks, developed country stocks in or out of the United States. The big differential, and this is the biggie, is that if you buy a U.S. stock, it's denominated in dollars. if you buy a foreign stock out of Europe and it's denominated in euros,
then you get the benefit of having the euro go up against the dollar.
You get
the currency exchange risk, but it's also a benefit in certain years.
You can. What you've done is you just added another layer of risk. If the as long as the euro is rising against the dollar, which it has been this last year, then wow, sure, yeah, that was a good deal. If the euro starts to fall against the dollar as it did at the end of 2016,
yeah, 2016, the euro, the companies in companies in Europe did relatively well, but most American investors in European companies saw a flat or negative return because the dollar was going up and the euro was going down. We get the reverse of that for the bit of the last year. And suddenly, just like with emerging, when you see a high return in an asset class, expect people to start saying, oh, the other asset classes aren't as good. Let's get in there. It is the reverse of the mentality we need to be using.
So when I say get into emerging market stocks, that's another issue. Emerging markets as an asset class, diversified emerging markets, of all the asset classes we track, has the highest long-term return.
Also the highest long-term risk.
Yes, but the point is sometimes you can go 10 years waiting for that return.
You don't have to wait very long to see the risk.
And so the issue is that balancing these out becomes very important and not leaving one and going to another. Anything that starts with a false premise, and the false premise that thing started with was U.S. stocks are overpriced. They're
right.
Not.
They're not. They are fairly priced, and I think they're not as cheaply priced as they were a year ago. We've had even 3 months ago, we were looking at the earnings of the companies of the United States in the S&P 500, and we were looking at the prices, and they were kind of going up in tandem. They were walking together. Earnings go up, price goes up in proportion. Prices jumped up ahead of earnings. We're about to have a big earnings boost from the tax cut.
Mm-hmm. And the stocks are rising this year because they're getting hints from CEOs that their fourth quarter numbers – the fourth quarter numbers are going to stink, the earnings.
Yeah, they have to because there's some tax write-offs if they have any money overseas anywhere.
Yeah, the president signed the bill before the end of the year. He intended to sign it in January, but he saw something on television and it caused him to sign it in December. Because he signed it in December, they have to capture the effect of the tax bill in their fourth quarter earnings.
Which is part of the reason why we expect fourth quarter earnings to be late in many cases because they've got to do a lot more calculations.
But they're also officially suggesting, forecasting, that their earnings will be substantially up in 2018. So the stock market is moving up now in response to some very, very solid numbers that are coming out of a lot of companies where they're expecting for the year 2018 to have substantially higher earnings than they had in 2017.
Now, sort of on the same subject, but this is a kind of a nice segue point. There's a headline in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, probably a week ago, a little less. It says, banks seek government help to track money laundering. Just think about that headline for a second. Banks seek government help to track money laundering. Wait a minute. Money laundering, isn't that something that the government's supposed to be investigating? Well, it has been delegated by the government to the banks. You know, the whole thing about how much you deposit at the bank and all that stuff. There's a lot of rumors that were based in fact that have been changed on how banks had different reporting requirements to the United States government on how much money was moving around. What banks are asking for right now is they would like to have a database of corporate ownership of privately held businesses and publicly held businesses so that they can tell if this corporation is owned by a foreign bank, well, they need to be flagged. If it's not, then they shouldn't be, or they should just be under a lighter scrutiny. So this concept, it seems like it's kind of coming out of nowhere. It is part of the transition to a new way of tracking money that came out of the cryptocurrencies, the blockchain. The blockchain is allowing banks this year, hopefully, to really get a good method of making sure that the people that have money, it's really their money, and when it transfers, it's really going to transfer right away. So the instantaneous transfer of money is coming out of this. But one of the issues that has to take place first is we have to verify who owns what money. And that's part of what the government has been asking the banks to do for a long time, but not giving them any money to do it with. They've been saying, where'd this money come from? And the bank says, we don't know. Look, this is just what we have. Somebody made a deposit here. We don't know where it came from, but here it is. And the bank and the government says, well, we don't know how to track this. Bank, you're going to have to ask them a lot more questions about where the money came from, which costs the bank money.
Well, if I could segue a little bit off of that.
Okay.
There's been interest in Bitcoin. Now, fortunately, since Bitcoin decided to kind of do a nose plant recently.
Couple of them, yeah.
There's less interest. But here's the point.
It'll come back. The interest will come back and until the mania is really dead.
Here's a point. We very consciously do our best to avoid immoral activities.
Yes.
And a lot of times greed...
What is the definition of an immoral activity? Let's say that real quick. It's not written in a book somewhere, but this is the definition we use.
Basically, things that cause evil, that's the nicest way. But the one I typically use is if everybody did it, everything would fall apart.
Yeah. If we're talking about littering, this is a great example. If you throw down a piece of trash, no big deal, right? You're just one person. What would happen if everybody did it? That's our definition that we use. If everybody did this, would this be a good thing? It's kind of like the golden rule,
but
it's a little stretch from it. But
when I say immoral activity in this case, what I'm referring to is cryptocurrencies. There's a lot of evidence right now, and it's growing, that North Korea, Russia, and Iran are using cryptocurrencies to bypass the bans and the restrictions that we put on them because of things they've done.
Right. And through hacking and otherwise, stealing it too.
And certainly significant parts of what Russia is doing to undermine us and Western Europe and to basically destabilize the political situation around the globe in their favor is being done with cryptocurrency. The Russian government now has an official cryptocurrency division whose intent is to launder money in such a way that they can do things illegally, trade things around illegally, ship arms to places illegally,
right,
and influence things illegally.
When we're talking about the elections from 2016, that has been kind of co-opted, that whole thing. It's been co-opted by the Democrats to say it was an effort to elect Trump. That's not what the intelligence documents say. What the intelligence community said is that the Russians were co-opting the election to increase chaos, to increase differences between voters, to make them as anti each other as possible. It worked. It wound up more benefiting Trump than Clinton. But I don't think that was intentional on the Russian side. I think that they were just doing what they do in just about every election. They want the rest of the world to be destabilized so they can take advantage of it. Well, how did they pay for it? How did they pay Facebook? One transaction back or the same transaction was in bitcoins.
Yeah, and a big chunk of, you know, North Korea is, we're trying to put sanctions on them to keep things from happening. And we know they're transferring oil at sea. By the way, I don't know if you followed this, but there was a big collision.
South Koreans have grabbed a bunch of tankers.
There was a big collision between a freighter and a tanker in the area between South Korea, China, and Japan in that area, and the tanker, virtually everybody on board the tanker is apparently dead. It turned out that the tanker had turned off its transponders and beacons several hours before the accident, and it was in the dark and in poor visibility. And as a result, the freighter that hit the tanker had no idea it was there. It was running in stealth mode, and it is the belief right now. It had come out of Iran, which is not coincidental.
Yeah,
It was setting up to meet another tanker to transfer fuel to the other tanker that was going to take it to North Korea. all these transactions, not all of them, but a majority of the transactions right now appear to be occurring through Bitcoin so that the governments can't track them.
Right. It's easier to use than crates full of paper money from the United States because it's a lot more liquid. They can turn around and sell it on almost any market right now. You can take a Bitcoin and sell it anywhere. Well, that's what Bitcoin was designed for, except that now it's being utilized by the self-appointed enemies of the United States.
So from a fundamental point of view, not to mention the fact that Bitcoin is extremely dangerous and we think eventually is going to implode.
Dangerous to investors, dangerous to transact
with. The price is up because people are buying it. And if you go out and buy Bitcoin, you are enriching North Korea, Iran, and Russia so that they can do more bad things to the United States. And I really think that is a bad idea. And that's just sort of a semi-editorial.
Yeah, I agree with that. The concepts that have come out of the cryptocurrencies, the concept of the blockchain, is a really fantastic method to do business across the board. It will increase security. It will make people, when they're making a transaction, know that the transaction is valid. This is an area that's important to understand. If they used blockchain on eBay or on a lot of the car auction sites, and this is just as a side note, one of the biggest areas of fraud in large denominations is fake car auctions. Go online and you do an auction and you say, oh, this is the perfect Corvette, this is the perfect Porsche, this is whatever it is, I'm going to participate. And you deposit the money in an escrow account in Northern or in Eastern Europe, in Hungary or in Croatia, the Czech Republic, or something like it, Bulgaria. Don't expect to get your car. And if they were using blockchain for title transfer here, it would make things a lot easier. We would know who owned the title without having a piece of paper. And that piece of paper is, I mean, how many, you've looked at a title, right?
I have. So
you've had titles to vehicles and to houses, and if you look at that, how easy do you think it would be to replicate that title?
Actually, quite easy.
Yeah, there's no copy blurring or anything. It's a relatively simple thing. Well, there's a raised seal from a courthouse somewhere. Well, that's easy, very easy to duplicate.
Well, actually, the raised seal is sort of history now. It's mostly, it's just a stamp.
Right. And when we look at it today on those online auctions, quite often you don't ever actually see the paper. You just see a picture of the paper, which is even easier to forge. So with a blockchain for titles, you would know who owns the car. And I mean, this is something when I was a teenager, I bought a motorcycle. You remember this. And I got a good deal on the motorcycle because they couldn't find the title. Well, we're not 100% sure that they owned the motorcycle. And we went and we acquired a title. We went to the courthouse with the numbers and checked for theft and went through the whole process of having them manufacture a new title. Well, this is now that there is another title to that motorcycle somewhere. Somewhere out there, unless it was destroyed, there are now two titles to that motorcycle. How do you track that? And when talking about ownership of property, that is what defines who we are as Americans. We own. The American dream is to own. And people pander to that occasionally in manias. But this concept of knowing who owns what is good for us as long as it's protected. This concept of no one knows who owns what, but anybody can transact in it in a secure way, is dangerous. It leads to people that don't want you to know what you're buying.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. You want to do some commercials now or you want to wait?
Let's do some commercials now. Well, actually, it's getting right on close to the half-hour mark. Okay, so we're going to have them talk over the top of us. Let me kind of sit something here, because a lot of people don't understand what blockchain is. I'm going to give an extremely simple analogy, and that is if everybody, you know, the old crime movies or the old spy movies, synchronize your watches.
It's not spy movies as military movies.
There were military movies. There were crime movies. There were spy movies.
Anytime we all want to do something together.
Okay, let's all put our watches together and synchronize. Blockchain for banks is the synchronization of their ledger books so that they all know where the money is right now and going forward, any transactions that take place on top of that, they're sharing with each other so they know where the stuff is. That's it. That, I mean, it's a fairly simple concept. It's amazing that it's taken us this long to come up with it, but that's all it is. It's just synchronizing our knowledge so that we're trading on this stuff. And that's kind of my wrap up, so that people aren't, there's a lot more detail, a lot more complexity to it, but that is the concept. And if you can grab a hold of that concept, that's what's going on. It's a shared ledger book.
Changing the subject a little bit, Wall Street Journal came out with a really good article after they did an investigation. On the 10th, they came out with this article. It's really worth listening to. Turn your ears on and listen carefully what I'm about to say. The Wall Street Journal went around to various discount brokers across the country that are supposedly non-commissioned discount brokers.
Three-minute stations, 3 minutes to your next.
And Schwab and others. And they did some investigating. And what they found was the people you talk to, the discount non-commissioned people that you talk to on the telephone, get paid differently according to what they recommend to you. And if they recommend one of the higher priced products, higher internal fees, they get paid more. And if they recommend something that is proprietary to the broker, like say Schwab's funds or at Fidelity, Fidelity's funds, or at USAA, USA funds, they get paid significantly more when you buy that fund than they do if you buy, let's say, a Vanguard fund, which doesn't pay anything to the discount brokers.
It's just like Miracle on 34th Street when, you know, the kids are talking to Santa Claus and a mother asks, well, where can I get this product? Should I buy it here? And he says, no, go down the street and around the corner and you can buy it down at this other store. If you go to a Fidelity company and you say, what should I buy? Don't be surprised when they recommend Fidelity products. And it's easy to see there. TD Ameritrade and Schwab were the other two discount brokers that the article talks about.
Yeah, but I've actually talked to people from USAA who say they get the same thing.
Well, I mean, yeah, and we love USAA. I mean, we love Vanguard. We love Fidelity. There's a lot of love that we have out there, but you should know it's a conflicted relationship.
Vanguard appears to be an exception. The people you talk to on the telephone at Vanguard are flat salary without regard to what you buy.
They're still going to recommend a Vanguard product because that's the platform that they work on. They only offer Vanguard. So
No. Their managed positions, they offer a lot of things. And they may be, you know, there could be a built-in prejudice, but one of the things I checked on was apparently at Vanguard, their flat salary without regard to what they offer. They don't get paid more for one thing and less for another. Whereas, and I may be wrong on that, but that's what I found when I researched.
Yeah, you're correct. They're not offered more on one than the other. You're still going to wind up leaving with a Vanguard product.
But the point is that Schwab, Fidelity, all the places that have proprietary products, and the ones that you would kind of expect that if you call up the person at Schwab and you say, what mutual fund should I buy in this area? They'd give you objective advice, but in fact, they're not licensed to give you objective advice. They're licensed as salespeople, as brokers, and their business is to make the most money they can for Schwab. It's nothing evil about that. Just that the assumption, I think, by most people when they call a discount broker that where they think the person is getting paid a salary, in fact, what they're getting paid on is what they sell.
Yeah, because when they say it's not commission-based, people think it's not commission-based. Well, this is a commission. Anyway, this is an area where it shouldn't be a surprise, but it still feels like a surprise. It feels like this is, you know, we're prejudiced. We believe that fiduciary advice should be offered. We believe that if there's a conflict of interest, it should be told to you. If you're getting paid in a certain way, it should be said in clear language, verbally and in writing, to the client to say, hey, when you give me this money, I'm getting paid, and here's where it is. You know they're getting paid. It's not like anybody out there goes, no, these people don't get paid. They work for free. That's a nice car that they got for free as well, and a nice house that they live in. No, we know that these advisors, that these brokers and financial folks are getting paid. What we completely advocate is full disclosure. I don't think most Americans have any trouble paying them, especially if they like the advice. Especially, I mean, I have no problem paying for someone to sell me a car or any other thing, but I would really like to know what I'm paying, because it lets me have a really good conversation with the whole concept of negotiation and where can I go. This is, we say the same thing on the medical world. Now that the insurance companies take over everything, there is no negotiation from a patient standpoint. You show up, you're charged a price. It somehow is getting paid. How much you pay is kind of in the dark until a bill shows up. Well, the bill doesn't even usually show up in these financial transactions. It's underneath. It's in there somewhere. You paid something. Did you pay too much? Did you pay too little? You don't know. If they just told you, here's how much you're paying before they charge you, I think everybody would be more comfortable with it. I think everybody, I mean, I think they'd be comfortable paying the fee. I think they'd be comfortable knowing that it was there. It's this not knowing thing or being told absolute lies. And that's a very common thing. We hear that, oh, the broker didn't take any money from me. They got paid by the company. Well, that's just, it's a little bit of an absurd statement. Yeah, where did the company get the money? They got paid by you. You need to know what you're paying for things. It's your money.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is 254-773-1400.
We can play the commercials now. Hopefully we won't have the news station pop in the middle of it or other things playing. So we'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join in our conversation, our phone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This guy over here is
Jeff.
I'm Jake. We're both McClure's. We're both bald. We both have beards. They're different colors. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure. You're really not good when I start the
introduction. Yeah, I thought I was going to do it. But anyway, telephone number in here, 773-1400. Of course, the area code is 254. And we had a little bit of interesting economic news this week. It really didn't have – it's kind of hard to find economic news buried underneath all the political news right now. But we did see consumer prices rise a bit in December.
Right, which is part of what we're talking about when we could be expecting inflation in the future.
But very importantly, we saw sales at U.S. retailers rise 0.4% in December from the prior month. Now, that's seasonally adjusted, and it really boils down to, because it's seasonally adjusted, theoretically it takes out the Christmas rush.
Yeah.
And
we don't really know how big that was yet, so the seasonally adjusted part is going to change a bit.
But if you take that out for a year, and it looks like from the trailing several months, it looks like that's a reasonable thing to do. We could see a 5% rise in retail activity, retail sales, in the following year, because there's several things to support that. Obviously, the fact that it's there and there's the number and we spent more than we spent last Christmas, and there's a lot of other things that typically go in there. Throw in the tax cut and the release of withholding tables that just came out from the IRS that gives more money into the pockets of consumers, and probability gets really high that we could see a 5% increase in retail sales in the United States over the next 12 months. And it's just an estimate, but still it's a pretty good guess based on everything we know. This is where it gets interesting. 70%, actually 67-point-something percent of the United States GDP, of the whole economy, is based on retail sales. Now, 5% times 70%, you begin to see the numbers there. This conceivably could kick the GDP up to about 2.7%, maybe even 3% for the year in 2018. Because there's no way of telling in advance what's going to happen as we go into 2018. Nobody's able to forecast that. But the indicators are there for an acceleration in retail sales next year. The indicators are there for an acceleration in overall activity. We've been talking about this for a couple of weeks, even before a lot of these other things came along. We're seeing durable goods orders go up. We're seeing construction starts go up. We're seeing a lot of hiring by long-term employers. By long-term employers, meaning companies where you have to hire somebody and they're not proficient at what they're doing for 6 or 8 months because they have to be trained. When there's a lot of hiring in that area, that means those companies have reason to believe that 6 to 8 months from now, they'll be doing more business than they're doing now. So it looks like 2018 may very well be a banner year in the economy. And as a matter of fact, this could be.
It was one. 2017 was one. I mean, when retail sales were up about 6% for the year, when we're talking about November, December, October, all those numbers, when we look at each of them year over year, we were up almost 6% in retail sales for the year. That is big.
It really could be that 2018 will be a peak year. And it's a little hard to call this far in advance. But at some point, there'll be a correction. At some point, things pull back because that's the nature of economic activity. We are boosted right now by the fact that the rest of the world is still in recovery mode. And the stimulation of the economy is still going on in Europe. The southern tier of Europe, the we used to call them the pigs, the countries along the Mediterranean.
Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain.
They still have double-digit unemployment.
But Portugal's not on the Mediterranean.
Well, no, but it's close.
There's a first letter in pigs is not. So
it's just around the corner.
It's around the corner.
But if you run across Europe, you'll notice that the unemployment up in Northern Europe, though, has dropped down to so low, they've reached full employment. So the total unemployment there is still 8-point-something percent, but
which,
still.
Which is going to cause unemployment in the southern countries to start coming back up, which is going to cause the Germans to give them lots of loans, and we may see a repeat of the last recession.
The Germans don't have a government right now. And they're spending. We think we got problems. They've now gone 4 months without a government.
Well, the big problem in the recession was the Germans gave a bunch of loans in the boom years to the southern Europeans, and then in the bad years, the southern Europeans couldn't pay them back. They forced them to pay them back during the down periods, and now it may be in the near future they're going to start issuing loans in the good times again to the southern Europeans, and next downturn they're not going to be able to pay, and thus the cycle continues.
And by the way, Greece still has a 21% unemployment rate.
Right.
But
which is much lower than it was just a few years ago.
So things are recovering in Europe. They're recovering in the developing part of the world. The rapid growth there is giving us a kick economically. But it could be – I haven't seen the end of this growth cycle, but 2018 may be the peak.
Yeah. Well, there are some other factors that are beginning here. For a long time, many, many years after the development of the personal computing device, the personal computer, the idea amongst the bigwigs, the people with big brains, was these are useless toys. They're not going to ever amount to anything. Xerox was big into them and then dumped out because there's not going to be a big deal. IBM sold out of the PC making business, and you go through the list of all the people that have been in and out of that thing. And the beginning of it, they said this isn't going to be a big deal. Kodak was the beginning of the digital camera age.
They invented it.
They got there too early, and so nobody wanted to buy it. So the CEO who made all these great predictions but was just in advance of marketability was fired, and now Kodak is having some difficulties. So this concept of, for a long time, new technologies, people see the promise, but it's not being realized yet, that's been around for 3D printing. So how long have 3D printing printers been around? I know somebody that got one 10 years ago. It was $5,000 at the time, and it made only things that were about 2 inches by 2 inches by 2 inches, so three dimensions. They're now available for less money, but they're still just gimmicks. They're still toys. Somebody might want to make some pencil holders. Well, you can buy a pencil holder for 20 cents. So what's the deal? Well, it's beginning. Toy companies are beginning to partner up with 3D printing companies, and sometimes they're just selling the plans directly for their toys to be printed on 3D printers. The beginning of usability starts generally in entertaining. PCs really hit it big in games long before they hit it big in business. Business came and now is a much larger percentage of the reason why people buy computers than games. 3D printers right now are purchased because they're toys. They're adult toys, that, although not with the XXX rating. They are adult toys in that we can fiddle with them and make things. And look, now I have a little face of Yoda. Or look, I made a thing. What are you going to use it for? I'm not really sure. I'm going to have a shelf of things that I printed for no apparent reason. There's no real marketability there until now. Things are really starting to come online to allow the home production of items that you would have gotten elsewhere. This is the next wave beyond the Amazon. When we go beyond Amazon and we say, we have been working for however long trying to get the shipping prices down, and in the process of getting shipping prices down, we're causing the postal service to go out of business, and we're causing the other companies to boom. UPS and FedEx are doing this great business out there. What happens when we want the item faster, or when we're way out in the boonies and it still takes a long time for something to be delivered? Well, drones can do it. That's going to be expensive, no matter how it's done. Drone, at least in the near term, is going to be an expensive delivery method. If you're willing to pay more, then that'll work. But in the meantime, between that time and now, expect to see more and more printed at home objects and that's kind of the future of industry. That's like the fourth industrial revolution, when you just buy raw materials and you reuse the raw materials that you've had from before. And you print it out for you. I mean, this goes to the extreme. This is decades away still, but printing your own clothes and then instead of washing them, just dumping them back in the machine and it breaks it down to its pieces so that you can make new clothes out of it again. And that's what we're looking at. That's kind of a futurist mentality. But when we're talking about a peak year in 2018, we see the technology that's being developed today as a completely new wave of things that is going to propel us into a higher quality of life. But between now and then, there's going to be some bumpiness. Just like when the tractor came online, it caused a massive hiring frenzy in the industrial world to make the tractors. But then not long afterwards, a massive layoff of the people who were doing what tractors came to replace. So keep that in mind. I think it's a good thing that we've been outsourcing our labor in industry for so long, because it's not going to have as big an impact on our citizens when you and I can create in our home our next computer or our next thing, and it won't really be us doing it. A machine will do it. We'll buy the plans to do it. It will create it for us. We'll go forward. It's the people in China and in Vietnam that if they don't have a new job besides making these items, they're going to have some problems. And I realize that I just said something that's a little bit earth-shattering to some people. I said it was a good thing that we've exported jobs outside of the United States, because they're jobs that won't be around at some point in the future anyway. All right. Do you have some other stuff to talk about?
Sure.
I've been kind of monologuing for a bit.
You know, I just said that the 2018 could see a peak in the economy, a peak in growth rate. At some point, we'll probably slow down a little bit. But here's an interesting, not necessarily a fact, but it's an indicator. Secular bull markets, and there's cyclical bull markets and there's secular bull markets in stocks. Cyclical bull markets are where it's run up and then it runs down, and it runs up and it runs down in a cycle. Every once in a while, and it is pretty rare, we get what's called a secular bull. We had one that started in 1994, for example, and that's not a particularly significant date to a lot of people, but in 1994, we had a secular bull market that started that ran for 6 years. It had nothing to do with cycles. It peaked out in 2000, way overpriced, and collapsed into 2002. Secular markets, secular bull markets begin when the real inflation-adjusted price of the S&P 500 gets high enough that a correction will not take it back down below its previous all-time high. And that's a little weird. But right now, if we take all inflation out of the system, we go back to 2000, and we say that's 100 on the S&P 500. The S&P 500 is now about 130, which means a 20% correction, or 20% is where correction sets in, but the as bad as a correction gets is about 30%. A 30-point drop will not take it back below its previous all-time high. We are probably in, and have just entered into fairly recently, and we're probably in 2016, 2017 timeframe, entered into what is probably, there's no certainty here, a secular bull market in stocks, which means it's liable to run for a number of years. We'll probably look back and see the two big dips we saw in 2015, which incidentally, those two dips took the S&P 500 back down after inflation to the same level it was in 2000.
Just as a side note here, you may have come up with a new nickname for us.
What's that?
Two big dips?
It could be.
Okay, so two big dips saw us drop down.
Uh-huh. So just, there's a lot of things going on out there right now. And earlier we got a caller that said, somebody said, I'm really glad people are saying the market's overpriced. Because as long as people are saying that the U.S. stock market is overpriced, it is by definition not. It's when people stop saying it's overpriced, you no longer get any indication, there's no warnings, everybody agrees, it's different this time, this could go on forever. The stock market will rise forever, even though it's at ridiculous numbers. That's when we need to be afraid, and of course we won't be. We will be in euphoria at that point, which is a country somewhere to the west of California, somewhere before you get to Hawaii, I think. Although Hawaii could be called the country of euphoria. But the point I want to make is we have an excellent opportunity right now. You as investors have an excellent opportunity to put money away, to take advantage of the tax cut, because you're going to have more cash flow. Your taxes are going to be lower in all likelihood. That is going to reverse itself at some point. Frankly, it looks like 2027 is where it reverses, because without running the deficit through the stratosphere, without running the national debt to an absolutely unsustainable level, the tax cuts will have to reverse in 2027. Some of them will start reversing as soon as 2025. That's not that far in the future. Somewhere 7 to 10 years from now, I think we're going to see a very nice reversal. The key is not to worry about the reversal so much as to take advantage of the present. If you turn around and spend the money that you get back from, that you get because the tax rates were lowered, you probably will wish in about 7 to 10 years that you hadn't done so. If you invest the money, if you have good savings first and then invest the money, there's some real potential for your running against the tide. But all this largesse, I think is the term that's used, that we're seeing right now from the government, someday will need to be paid back. And the someday is written into the tax bill, 2027. Just put that in your mind and recognize that that is a likely reality in the future. There's nothing certain about the future. So sometime around 2027 to 2030, have your ducks together, have your savings in place, have your investments set up, and when things start to deteriorate and go crazy at that point, you might want to think about doing something different.
Yeah,
but between now and then, it's
a good
investment time.
You know, a lot of the listeners here have a little bit of a prepper mentality. Prep for this, too. It's funny that a lot of the people that have this kind of prepper mentality are preparing for disasters in all these other areas, but they're not preparing by paying off their own debt or by building a cash reserve. Make that part of the prep. I mean, it's a lot more likely that we'll have an economic downturn than we'll have a social economic collapse. So let's prep for things in order of severity. And so pay off your debt, invest appropriately, have savings. Now is the time to do that. And when people are talking about paying it off their debt when they're unemployed, I have to take them slowly through some concepts of now is probably not the time to pay off the debt. Get a job, then pay off the debt. You don't know how long you're going to be unemployed. So you can't, if you pay off all your debt now and you used all your cash to do it, now you've got more debt and less cash. So maintain savings for bad times, especially in the good. This is the time when everybody else is going to be talking about, you know, consuming and so on. We're seeing statistics on that. Now, I said last hour that I was going to talk about this. Big change in the military retirement took place. It became important to know about last year, but it became real January 1st of this year. January 1st of 2018, the blended retirement system came online. If you've been in the military for less than 12 years, or you've got something like 4,800 hours or so National Guard service, then you can, or less, then you can choose to opt in or use the old system. If you joined the military, either enlistment or officership, after the first of the year, you'll be automatically enrolled in this blended system. There's some important factors to know here. Things are different. The pension is changing. There's matching in the TSP if you go this route. It's important to go online. The government's given, in this case, some pretty good educational materials on it. If you need help, ask, but don't expect anybody in the military to tell you what you should do here. The counseling to the commanders is tell them to get educated, recommend that they invest for retirement, recommend that they plan for it, but they're not allowed to give you advice on it. The reason is because the law says in order to give that advice on a retirement plan, one must give fiduciary advice. So get educated on this if you're in the military. There are some potential massive benefits. The blended system means that if you're not expecting to work the whole 20 years, go full career in the military, if you're going anytime in between, you get to keep the matched money in the TSP as long as you've been there 2 years for vesting. So think about if you're career military or you're not, that's going to influence the decision. But get in there. There's a lot of good information. And if you need help, there are people out there that can help you on it. Do your due diligence on that, too, because not everybody out there that says they're out to help you is really going to give you the most help. They may be helping themselves more. So keep that in mind as well. Do your research. There's some possible amazing benefits. There's also a lot of research that you need to do to make sure that it is a benefit for you. It's different for every person. If it's right for you, don't turn around and tell all your friends that it's right for them too, because they have different lives than you are. So that's kind of across the board, big changes. Be aware of them. There's another thing in that there's a lump sum option in this blended thing. Most people aren't going to have it available right away because it's only available at that retirement point. And that is a big lump sum payment in lieu of a certain percentage of your pension for a period of years up to full retirement, 67. Taxation on that is full income, so be really careful. It might be a big income that puts you in the top 1% of earnings or earners for the year, and then you can be the hated 1% for 1 year, but also get to pay the much higher tax rates of the 1% for that year. So keep that in mind as well. There's a lot of stuff out there, and we're about out of time for this week. So if you would like to contact us off the air, we have a local number available with voicemail waiting.
It's area code 254-947-1111. That's 947-1111.
If you would like to reach that number toll-free, it's 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. That's for those of you that don't use cell phones, I guess. Toll-free is a funny thing these days. If you would like to learn more about what we do, you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts of this program going back years. We've got newsletters. We've got our ugly mugs and our fantastic and amazingly great staff. If you would like to email us directly, it's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEN.